Welcome to The Weekly on WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. I'm Jamie Yu, and with me is Owen Anderson, and we are the news directors for WOBC this academic year. We hope you are all doing well. For today's show, we have Jonas Nelson, a writer from the Oberlin Review. Later on, we'll have our own conversation. We're interested in talking to Jonas about his off-the-cuff interview with sociology professor Rick Baldos. Content warning. This episode contains discussions of anti-Asian racism, gun violence, and stabbing.
So, Jonas, thank you for joining us. Would you like to introduce yourself, please?
I'm Jonas Nelson. I'm a first year. I recently had an interview with Rick Baldos, a teacher at Oberlin College, for the Oberlin Review.
Mm-hmm. And we wanted to start by asking you, how did this pitch get to you, or why did you want to take this on?
I'm currently in a journalism class, and we had signed up to write for the review, and I got sent pitches, and one of them was to talk to Professor Baldos about the recent Atlanta shooting, and he had written an op-ed in the Washington Post, and I then read it and found it very interesting and kind of wanted to talk to someone who had such a an op-ed in such a high-profile paper, and just kind of to figure out what his process was behind writing a piece that has such a serious topic.
Yeah. You said you read the op-ed. Can you talk more about what you thought of it?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting because it focused on telling the entire history of anti-Asian sentiments in America. And I thought it was just very interesting because he seemed to try and take it from a point of trying to help people kind of make sense of the situation rather than kind of give his own personal opinion on it, really. And I thought that that was really interesting, and it kind of helped me think about it. And so I kind of wanted to understand how someone like a sociologist or an expert in the field of like Asian immigration and like racism, like how they kind of interpret an event like the Atlanta shooting.
And I guess going off of that, yeah, since Professor Baldos mentioned both his book and his op-ed and how it delved into early Asian American history and its history of racial violence, did you learn anything new, or did anything surprise you from what he told you?
I think the idea of him talking about how he said how much he kind of had to cut, like he said he was going to go into kind of the history of even like Japanese and Korean sentiments, and he was just going to go into this very overarching one about immigration in America. And talking to him, it was really interesting because I think I knew a lot about what he said in the article, although I did learn a bit about San Francisco Chinatown, which is where I'm from, so that was pretty interesting. But I think learning about how much kind of more niche info he considered putting in, I learned a lot about kind of like little smaller parts of his article from there.
That's super cool that you're from San Francisco.
From your conversation with Professor Baldos, was there also any parts that didn't make it into the article just because of space for the review, but still resonated with you?
There was a lot of parts about kind of who he was writing for, which is what I was originally interested in. Like a lot of parts to me, we talked about kind of paywalls and how he kind of reckons the fact that Washington Post has a paywall usually. So kind of how he feels about putting kind of what he thinks is important information behind something that makes it so a lot of people can't read his work. And I think a lot of that got cut from the review article. And I can see why, because it was a bit more conversational and less about the original topic. He talked a lot about what other people write or have written about it, and so I thought that a lot of his more personal things about his process rather than the events themselves were cut, and I thought that those were some of the really interesting pieces, but I do understand why they were taken out.
Can you tell us more about those?
He talked a lot about how other people would write and about how they would kind of sensationalize different stories, and that didn't make it in a lot, and I thought that was really interesting. And he also talked pretty extensively about his process of thinking about the events. I mean, a lot of it kind of about how to cut down his op-ed. He was talking about, like, not exactly what he was cutting, but his process of getting from kind of like thousands of words into like under 1,000 were interesting. Just a lot of the more minute details of the process were pretty interesting, considering I've been doing more journalistic work in the past few months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and honestly, while you were talking, I found it pretty, I don't want to say funny, but interesting how even professors can struggle a bit with writing too much and then having to condense their work. It's like you think that, you know, oh, a professor wouldn't have this problem, but really, like, if you have a lot to say, then you have a lot to say.
Yeah, no, it was surprising, like, listening to how much he talked about just, like, sitting there completely unsure of, like, what he wanted to say at all. Which is funny, considering, like, he's an expert in, like, these matters, and still even he kind of had to, like, pace around a lot.
Yeah, and this might be a little bit off topic, but I'm not sure if you've declared a major yet, but I guess if, depending on how familiar you are with sociology in general, did anything from your conversation with him kind of teach you anything new about the subject?
Yeah, I think I'm not a sociology person. I'm kind of more focused on politics, so we got a bit into that. To me, the idea of, since sociology is kind of so analytical, and in the sense it seeks to kind of explain, or kind of like, it kind of seeks to make like very like sweeping statements. And so what he would talk about is like kind of reckoning the idea of like sociology is supposed to be like very explanatory and kind of like dogmatic in ways. And the fact that in such a small amount of like in just 800 words, you can't really make like an overarching kind of like theory of like anti-Asian sentiments. And so kind of like what was interesting is kind of that struggle of having to say something unique in such a small amount of words without also trying to like bite off more than you can chew. Like I really got the sense that it's kind of this balancing act of trying to both stand out and not maybe like, yeah, not stand out or like not do too much and then also still say something interesting.
So since this was an OTC, which is a transcribed interview, we were wondering how did you go about kind of coming up and asking questions that would inform the reader but also give Professor Baldos space to talk in the conversation, since he is an academic and an expert in the field?
I tried to think of a lot of different ways in which I could give... I tried to always make the questions kind of about him and his process in a way and kind of relating them to the event so that he could talk kind of both about the event and then how it impacted him. Because I thought that what would be interesting is kind of the idea of both like making... Well, the idea is that if someone had read the op-ed, they would kind of understand like what he was talking about. And then what I wanted to focus on was kind of like how, like going like behind the curtain and kind of like how he writes a paper like that. So trying to give him a lot of spaces to just openly talk about his process and not kind of trying to... I was trying to not ask him very specific questions about certain areas of the op-ed, because I kind of wanted to get more general kind of quotes about how, like, how it felt to write the entire thing. And so that kind of resulted in a lot more sweeping answers, where he would kind of go through each part of the paper and describe his process, rather than just talk about a single piece of it, which I asked him about.
In the review article, he does say how he's trying to add to this public discourse, and obviously the Washington Post is a big platform for that. Did he say anything about the process of creating this article and then also working with the Washington Post to get it published? Because it's not every day that a professor from Oberlin is published in the Washington Post.
I think the Washington Post asked him. He said it was his second time writing for the Washington Post, and I think he made it sound like they had asked him if he wanted to write an article. He talked about, like what he said is that his dream is to write for the New York Times, in which he says, for the New York Times, you just kind of write something and then like submit it, and you're one of thousands. And it's just, if you don't get a response, obviously you didn't make it. But what he made it sound like is that he kind of has a rapport with the Washington Post, like he's done it before for them with kind of like similar sociology topics. And so, yeah, it seemed like he was kind of comfortable and more used to writing with the Washington Post, but then he talked about how there are the kind of like still like the big dogs like the New York Times that he's still kind of aspiring to write for.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really interesting to hear about. We want to pivot a little bit and ask more about you and your time with the review. And earlier you mentioned how this was actually your first article for the review. So how did that go for you? What was the process like?
So I'd gotten my pitch and I was supposed to write it actually a week earlier than when it came out. And I was unable to get, Rake was unable, or Valdez was unable to have an interview time that week. So we had pushed it to the next week. But I talked a lot with a few editors, talking about kind of what questions to ask, and then kind of what the format should be like, and then what edits I should make. And then Monday I did the interview with Professor Valdez, and then I'd spent the next day and a half making edits, and then I think it had published on Wednesday, or I think it might have been Tuesday. But it wasn't, I think because it was kind of more of a transcript, it wasn't as complex of a process as some other edits may be. A lot of it was kind of getting rid of the little kinks of like someone like transcribing a speech. You have a lot of different like filler words. So I think a majority of the time was coming up with the questions and then editing the transcript.
This being your first article for the review, and you said it was also partly for a class that you're taking. In the future, do you want to continue reporting?
Yeah, I mean, I may. It's kind of, I mean, like right now, I'm kind of focused on finishing up school, but I think possibly next year or the year after, I would be interested in joining one of the news organizations around Oberlin. I definitely did enjoy it. I think I was never someone who did. I never did like school newspaper before. So I found it interesting, and I think I definitely would pursue it in the future. Maybe not as like a year-round thing, but I definitely am interested in it more after doing this interview.
Glad to hear. So before we wrap up, we just wanted to ask you if there was anything else you'd like to add?
No, I don't think so.
Thank you so much, Jonas.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And now we would like to air the extended off-the-cuff interview with Professor Baldos. Jonas's article was originally published in the Oberlin Review News section on April 7th, 2021.
So I wanted to ask you a few questions about your recent op-ed in the Washington Post about mm-hmm. the Atlanta shooting, and more specifically, a few questions kind of about your process in writing the article and who you kind of wrote it for. Mm-hmm. And so kind of something I thought about in reading this is like how you got the inspiration, because a lot of pieces I've read regarding tragedy, a lot of them describe their process as when the tragedy happens, they kind of have a lot of jumbled kind of chaotic thoughts about it, and they're not really mm-hmm. sure how to put them together. And then kind of some revelation or other event in their personal lives kind of helps them like center their thoughts and organize them. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, like, did you have the structure of this piece in mind, like right after the shooting, or did you kind of go through like a series of different thoughts on it and then eventually arrive on kind of what you wanted to say about it?
Yeah. Great series of questions. Right. So I work researches in the area of Asian immigration with a sort of sub specialization in anti-Asian violence, specifically about Filipino immigrants in the US during the 1920s and 30s. So it's a topic I've spent a lot of time thinking about over the years. I wrote a book that sort of addresses some of these topics. So in terms of the specifics of the op-ed, right, this really big event happened, you know, thought about, like a lot of people sort of, you know, thought about the tragedy part of it. And then, you know, pretty quickly, right, there's a lot of news coverage of the event. And then also relatively quickly, a lot of think pieces, including op-eds about, you know, how to make sense of this tragedy. So, you know, probably a day after I started thinking about, you know, what can I add to this discussion? You know, so wrote down a few notes about things that I thought were kind of interesting about what had happened. You know, and we were also getting the information about the confession and the police response and how it fit into this kind of larger kind of surge in anti-Asian violence over the past year or so. And so I wrote down some notes about some things I thought were interesting or important, But then, you know, the challenge is, right, you're sort of writing for the news cycle, which means you got to write fast, because I've done this before. This is the second op-ed I've done with the Washington Post. And then you're also responding to other op-eds and other people that are weighing in. Sometimes it's people being interviewed for news stories. Other times it's op-ed style writing. So then you also have to kind of edit down, well, someone already said that, or someone already talked about this. So then it's a question of what kind of unique contribution do I have to make? And I think, you know, in my op-ed, you know, the angle is sort of about how in these kinds of incidents of violence, they're often sort of explained, at least by the perpetrators, as acts of self-defense, even though clearly they're offensive acts, and how kind of historically people that commit these kind of violent acts, and I, in my book, and I focus more on kind of collective action, like vigilante violence of groups of people. But I thought that there was also some parallels with this particular individual, that he believed that he was, you know, going to eliminate a problem, to use his words. And there was, you know, a couple of the news stories mentioned that, you know, because one way to try to make, to the extent that we can make sense of an insane kind of explanation for what had happened was, you know, if you were a sex addict, for instance, which is his framing of the situation, you could take your own life as a way to eliminate the problem. Why would you seek retribution against the women that worked in these places? And one article I read said that he said, oh, I wanted to eliminate the problem for other people. In other words, I'm going to save other souls by eliminating the problem for them, the others who are tempted by these women, these sort of Asian sex workers. I'm going to help them, right? Which again is very self-serving kind of narrative. Again, instead of acknowledging or kind of being accountable for your own issues or problems, you blame or scapegoat someone else. So that was where I wanted to kind of engage, right? By talking about how there's this sort of long history of kind of vigilante violence sort of directed at kind of minority groups, where the people doing the violence scapegoat the victims of the violence and say they're responsible, right? They crossed a line. They, you know, whether it's engaging in kind of mixing with white women or whether it's engaged in radical labor activism, they did something to provoke us. So our violence is justified, right? And it's, again, often framed as self-defense, right? We were defending the community against communist subversives or against Chinese prostitutes who were debasing the white families by luring men. That was the kind of surreal in sort of the 19th century and early 20th century in Chinatown in San Francisco. A lot of the social reformers, you know, would condemn Chinatown for being these kind of vice districts and would talk about prostitution and opium. But it would always be that the men, mostly white men, who go to prostitutes or sex workers or who go to opium dens, it's not their fault. They accidentally found themselves there and then were sort of manipulated by these sort of evil kind of immigrants to engage in bad behavior.
Yeah, and kind of going off what you said about the idea of trying to build on what other people have said rather than restate it, and mm-hmm. kind of you saying that it's your second piece in the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. I was wondering who you had in mind as the sort of who you'd want the ideal person reading your article to be, because like with Washington Post, there's a paywall behind most mm-hmm. articles. And so I'd assume that the people reading this who would have a subscription to a journal would be kind of more tuned into the news cycle. And sure. So I was wondering if you had any kind of reservations about putting such relevant and like important commentary mm-hmm. behind a paywall. And yeah. sort of like who you had in mind when you were like writing this piece.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's a tough kind of problem, right? The kind of shifting kind of news organization. I mean, for me, you know, I'm not a subscriber to the Washington Post. I mean, I read it, you know, when I can, and there is a paywall, but at least in my experience, you usually get around 3 free articles per month, at least I'm able to access, or it's never totally clear, but it's roughly 3 or 4 articles. And then at least I can, you know, using a different browser or a different device, you can get 3 on another, on your phone or on your laptop. So at least my own sense from my own kind of viewing habits is you can usually get access to one of these articles if you want, especially given people who don't necessarily aren't diehard readers of those, kind of like the Washington Post, for instance, meaning they probably haven't reached their three limit or whatever it is on that website. But again, I read it enough to know that you get a certain number of free articles. I think with the New York Times, it's isn't five per month. And
yeah,
Washington Post may not be as explicit. I mean, we get a free subscription through the college, but yeah, so the access part is a challenge. I mean, the other side of it is you want the biggest audience possible if you think you have something to say. And, you know, the New York Times is probably the most prestigious. It's also the hardest to get into. And, you know, their system at the New York Times, right, unless you have a connection there, right, you just submit blindly and they say, if you haven't heard from us in 3 days, you can send it somewhere else. So it's a little like, okay.
Yeah,
right, it's like sort of mailing something into the void. And, you know, I read once years ago that there was something they said they got, you know, a few hundred sort of blind submissions a month and only accept a really small number, right? So most of the op-eds from guest submissions are from people who are invited to do it, meaning the New York Times, like, who's an expert on anti-Asian violence and, you know, reaches out to those people so they get invited to submit versus just cold submission, which is what someone like me would do, where the chances of getting in are really slim. Sometimes if you're exactly at the right time, I think you can have it happen. But the Washington Post, for whatever reason, has been more receptive to my stuff. But for sure, the New York Times is a big goal.
Kind of something else, because you talked about kind of having to fit within a news cycle is, and this piece came out, I think, exactly 10 days after the shooting had happened.
Mm-hmm.
Is like, how long did this article take to write? And then something I noticed was the part about the spokesman for the police office and the bad day
mm-hmm.
thing is that a few days after that had come out, there was a big discussion online about whether that had been misconstrued, because mm-hmm. people had said that, oh, he was paraphrasing the shooter. And then others mm-hmm. said, like, paraphrasing the shooter with such kind of like, or like kind of saying it in a way. Yeah. Yeah. Like matter of fact, or like, yeah, just parroting his words is essentially mm-hmm. like reinforcing the white supremacist anyways, even if he wasn't directly saying it himself. And so,
yeah,
was like new information coming out, was that kind of significantly affecting like how you were writing it?
Yeah, it was. So, I mean, you know, the event happened and I heard about it that night and, you know, sort of paid attention just to the kind of basic news information that we had. And I think it was maybe the next day that I saw the stuff about the sheriff's office and their comments. And then probably within a day of that, there was the sheriff's office saying it was misconstrued. So I watched it, the news conference online, a few different times to make sure I understood the sort of intent. And I feel pretty confident that I understood what they were saying, which is this very matter of fact, just repeating what the killer said is sort of without much scrutiny. I mean, we don't always just take the word. Like, if someone says denies that they committed a crime, then we don't, oh, okay, well, they denied it, so it must not have happened, right? We don't take what a killer says at face value. And I think, you know, one of the kind of criticisms very quickly was kind of editorializing on behalf of the sheriff's office, which is really not supposed to do. And I guess I found the kind of glibness of the sheriff, who was the spokesman, to be kind of jarring. The fact that he sort of, you know, he had a bad day and he snapped and this is what happened, just sort of almost no sense of kind of empathy with the victims, just this kind of, well, you know, he was lured by temptation and he was struggling, so that's what happened. It just seemed like a really bizarre, and then of course we learned that same sheriff was posted Facebook stuff,
like China virus, grew in a lab.
Yes. So suggesting perhaps that he wasn't the best kind of, you know, that his views on this matter may not have been totally impartial. So that's the other thing, right, is you don't want to jump in too quickly before you know as many of the facts as possible. And like I said, you know, so you gather the information that's available. You see sometimes the contestation where there's an accusation, the sheriff's department's overstepping, and then them denying it, and then you have to go make sure you understand what exactly was said, And then I wanted to double check about the Facebook stuff. Did he really post that? And I think sometimes people, oh, I was hacked or something like that. And I also, again, you kind of, so maybe it was 24 hours later, I started thinking about, okay, I think I can write an op-ed. And then again, it's the question of what's the angle, right? So when I do these things, and I've done quite a few, I did one for Salon, I've done them for like Truth Out. So I've done, you know, maybe five or six over the past 4 or 5 years. Writing quickly is sort of a challenge, especially like in my case, right? I tend to draft a bunch of notes, which essentially usually comes up to around a 2000 word op-ed, which no one accepts. Right. I think, you know, New York Times and Washington Post are usually tell you they want around 800 words or so. So then you also have to kind of figure out what exactly, how can you be as sort of punchy as possible, right? How can you edit it down to this word length? And again, to what extent can you kind of carve out your own niche within all the other information and op-eds being produced? Because there was a lot. So the combination of, you know, gathering facts and then trying to figure out what I can contribute that sort of original took me around 5 days or so. And then I submitted it and I think it was accepted the next day. And then you start working with an editor, actually a couple editors. And then it came out a day later. So I think from start to finish, it was probably 5.5 days and then another 2 days before it came out in the paper.
Yeah, kind of speaking to that point of like editors and that, like as an expert in or like a researcher in race and immigration law, I'm sure you could have written like hundreds upon hundreds of pages about like these underlying dynamics. And so like, and then kind of having to take just like years of understanding and research into 800 words, were there any kind of pieces that you like really wanted to talk about but felt maybe were too like complex for an op-ed or like just weren't relevant enough? And like which pieces were those?
I mean, sort of one part of it as well. So right, there was the initial incident, and then maybe 48 hours later, there was President Biden made a sort of set of comments about it where he said it was un-American. And then maybe a day later, Harris and Biden went to Atlanta, right? So that was also part of like trying to figure out, you know, how to incorporate their engagement, right? Their denunciation of the events and going to visit the Asian community in Atlanta and some of the families. So I think in the original article, I had a few examples of violence against other communities of color sort of historically and how those were also framed as sort of defensive versus offensive. But ultimately, right, this was about the particular incident that was targeting Asians. So focused on that. I also had more examples, like I had examples about Japanese being targeted, I had examples about South Asians being targeted. But again, there's just no way those, that would have been, each section would have been 350 words on the, in and of themselves. So just the word constraints sort of limit what you can do. And that's one of the things that you sort of get worried about. It's like, well, you know, like, I couldn't be as definitive as I wanted. So someone might be able to say, well, you didn't talk about this. Or you didn't talk about that, which is a very common critique of an op-ed. And you're like, well, you do that in 800 words. It's really difficult. I guess ultimately you just have to learn to let go and know that you can't write the definitive in this format, a definitive take on the history and present of anti-Asian violence or these kind of different stereotypes about Asians. You can only, you know, kind of really have one hook. In my case, it's about the kind of framing, you know, vigilante violence as defensive and having a few examples of how that played out historically and how it links to the kind of current incident.
Yeah. Was there anything else you wanted to say?
Well, just so you know that, you know, I think it's important that scholars, you know, who are in a position to kind of engage with sort of the public do so, especially in times of kind of, I'm gonna call it crisis about sort of anti-Asian violence, right? Professor Lee in Comparative American Studies and myself have both kind of been out there trying to kind of engage with the issue and kind of, you know, share our expertise and help, you know, this community, Oberlin community, kind of understand the issues at hand and also kind of, use our expertise as a kind of way to kind of, you know, show the outside world that Oberlin is engaged in these issues. Faculty, students are, you know, we had this teach-in last week, and there's been a series of other events as well. So just nice to be able to kind of put Oberlin on the map for good reasons, to be at the news, you know, making a kind of positive contribution to the discourse.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great talking to you.
Yep. Thanks, Jonas.
So in another segment of our show, we discuss an off-the-cuff interview with sociology professor Rick Baldoz on anti-Asian violence. We did an interview with the writer, Jonas Nelson, class of 2024, but we have some time now where we wanted to add to the conversation. So I have Jamie here with me. How are you doing, Jamie?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you doing?
Pretty good. So we're going to begin by taking a step back to over a year ago. Jamie wrote an article for the Oberlin Review on March 13th, 2020, reporting on a program by Oberlin's Chinese Student Association, which was focused on communities in the context of COVID-19. So, Jamie, can you tell us more about your article?
Sure. So I wrote this article back in March 2020, and it was actually the week that we were all sent home. So this was the last issue of not the very last issue of the semester, but the last issue we did for the print edition and while we were all on campus. And that week in particular was, well, extremely unexpected and turbulent in how rapidly all these changes were happening. But at the time, I was the arts and culture editor, and I was already kind of caught up in the frenzy of the weekly print schedule. And I feel like throughout the semester, I had kind of been taking on pitches that were just very immediate and fairly straightforward. I did a lot of event previews and coverage, and I noticed on the event calendar while I was writing up pitches for that week that Chinese Students Association was holding a program at the Allen. And throughout the semester, I had kind of been putting COVID-19 to the back of my mind, because I remember when I was doing winter term in January that year, I'd already started kind of tuning into that news cycle. And I think it's something that a lot of people overlook, but because I have extended family living in China, I was really worried about them at the time. And because of that, I feel like I was focusing on COVID before a lot of students may have been. And I think, you know, when I hear other Americans talking about how, like, oh, this pandemic took over our lives in March, but really, for a lot of, I think a lot of Asian Americans, they were really thinking about this as early as like late December or January 2020, just because of how it was relevant to them before then.
Yeah, it is called COVID-19.
And, you know, as the semester continued, I wasn't really thinking about it as much. Towards like late February, I started seeing news articles about various violent acts against Asian Americans. And they weren't so physically violent at the time. There were a lot of just ignorant remarks, but I still found it pretty upsetting.
Now, this is February of 2020?
Yes. And then by the time mid-March rolled around, I really felt like I should take the opportunity to really speak up and use my voice and talk about this. And I thought that the program at the Allen was a good way to do that. So I got in contact with Wen Ling from CSA, and I also talked to Emma Loeb, who was the Allen's curatorial assistant for the Office of Academic Programs, and also Hannah Kinney, who was the assistant curator of academic programs, and they were working at the Allen at the time. So they were my first interview on that Monday, and then I talked to Wen Ling, and then I also reached out to some Asian classmates in some of my classes, and they contributed some comments over email. And I really liked how the article came together, because beyond just the event coverage, I also wanted to take the moment to raise a bit of awareness about what was going on, because this was like a whole year before #StopAsianHate began. And it was a real problem back then too. So that was the overall purpose of my article.
Yeah, and going off that, in your piece, you talk a bit about Fox News host Jesse Waters and his claims about the origins of the pandemic, which was reported by Salon. And some of the students who interviewed for the article expressed concerns on how media in the U.S. framed the COVID-19 pandemic. Can you talk about this in particular in the context of the widespread anti-Asian sentiment and violence that we see today?
This is a very complicated issue because it delves a lot into international politics and things like that. I don't think it's as easy as just like the U.S. is demonizing Asia, because all these world governments do have like a lot of baggage. And but I will say, like, Jesse Waters's comment is very much, or it was very much based on a lot of unfounded claims and really outdated history about Asia and China in particular. And I think especially early on last year, there was a lot of big like news reports that were kind of using scare tactics and saying like cases were rising and citing all these numbers and statistics. I remember a lot of people really had their eyes glued to the Johns Hopkins like online like case tracker, where they had like the number of cases every day, especially in the beginning. And what some of the quotes in my article talked about were how a lot of Western media tends to ignore how Asia was actually responding to the pandemic. And I think that ties into today's rhetoric, where people want to blame Asia for the pandemic, but at some point, these countries do have to, you know, admit to some of their responsibility and how they handled the crisis. Because yes, it did spread from Asia, but after a point, you have to acknowledge that just the way that the US in particular responded, how masks became politicized, how the vaccine is being politicized right now, that is a direct contributor to the number of cases we have here. And I mean, early last year, I was really concerned about my family back in China, but they've honestly been living like pretty normally for the better part of like half a year at this point. And we're the ones that are still, you know, doing remote learning in some cases, or, you know, cases are still up. So I think at its bare essentials, it's like people just want to find people to blame. And that unfortunately extends to stuff beyond microaggressions, and then it becomes physical and violent.
The sort of pointing fingers at particular countries or populations when, just talking about the U.S. got its cases from all over. I mean, we had strains from Europe and I mean, probably Canada too, and South America as well. So like it became a global pandemic, and we need to share the blame globally for our response to it.
Yeah. And the reason why I say it's complicated is because we can't treat China or the Chinese government is like completely blameless, because there is some truth in the fact that the government tried to suppress information in the very beginning. And that's something that we can't like absolve blame for. But at some point, it becomes the US's response as well.
Right. It's something that multiple governments did. If we could turn away for a second, because I think we're kind of circling this point of a tradition of pointing fingers. Let's revisit the op-ed in the Washington Post written by Oberlin sociology professor Rick Baldoz. You've been able to listen to the OTC conducted by Jonas, and you've read a bit of the actual op-ed. Can you share your reaction to it?
Sure, yeah. So the op-ed, what I found interesting is that now that I'm actually taking Asian American history with Professor Shelley Lee, I do actually know a lot of the context of what Professor Baldoz was talking about. And I think that informed a lot of my response to the initial Atlanta shootings, because if anything, it's been saying a lot of people don't know about the history of violence against Asian people, because I think largely Asian American history is a narrative that we are not taught in schools, that we don't know about. And even today, you know, Asian Americans are an extremely rapidly growing group, but we still only make up about 5% of the total population. So there are plenty of Americans who may have never met an Asian person in their life, and who just, you know, don't know as much as they should. And I hope that the article or the op-ed is informative to those people. But I do recognize a lot of what I've been learning in his article, particularly how he goes into the history of how Asian women in particular have been demonized and sexualized, and how even Chinatown in particular, we read an article in Shelley's class about how Chinatown was cast as this sort of like very deviant, mysterious, somewhat exotic, but also like dangerous place. It was diseased, it was dirty. You went there to engage in like illegal activities. The people there were shifty and shady, and like you should stay away from them. And it was like a very like strict binary or racial divide in which Asian Americans were just cast to the outside and just treated as un-American. And even the title of the op-ed references the sheriff's bad day comment, and honestly, I believe that was the point of most outrage from a lot of people who heard about the shooting. Because what it does is it takes these people who have already been relegated to the margins, and it just further pushes them away by saying that they didn't matter, and that it was just an excuse for the man who killed them. And not just like why he killed them, but also in reference to his apparent addiction. And somehow it takes these people who died and turns them into and blames them, basically, and saying that like you are inherently like this and you enabled his addiction and that's why he killed them. As if they had a reason to be the victims of such a hate crime. And as Professor Baldo says in his article, it's a long tradition of transposing blame for criminal acts onto victims of racialized violence. And it's extremely unfair. But it really just speaks to how these racialized images have endured over literal centuries, and how, like, even today, there's still this idea that Asians are not American enough, or that just small, like, it even manifests in small assumptions, like the assumption that we can't speak fluent English, or that we don't celebrate certain holidays, or that the people that we associate with, or that where we live, or how we learn. So it's just a lot of small things add up, basically, and it all traces back to actually a very deeply racist history that a lot of people might not realize or know about.
Yeah, just going back to Professor Valdez's point is that this history, although not widely taught, which is perhaps one of the reasons why it's not widely known, this trend, although it sounds crazy to talk about, is unsurprising in the sense that it is extremely prevalent throughout U.S. history.
Mm-hmm. And above all, I want to say, like, this, what's happening right now is not new. People think that it's new, but it's not new at all. It goes back centuries, and this is kind of just the latest iteration of it, and it's really sad, but that's how it is. That's what's been happening.
Can we also get your reaction to the OTC by the Review, the interview with Professor Baldos?
Yeah, so I listened to that, and I really appreciated how Professor Baldos kind of invoked the same sentiments as his op-ed. He talked about, you know, blaming how Asian women have been blamed for their racialized images, even though it's something perpetuated by white supremacy. He talked about the sheriff's bad day comment. And what I find interesting is how Professor Baldos kind of, in the OTC, you can hear it, but he kind of chuckled to himself while talking. And it was just kind of like a, I can't believe I'm saying this kind of moment. And I think that's very relatable, because even right now you can hear it a little bit in my voice. He talks about the shooter's motive, and while he's doing that, it's kind of this disbelief of, like, I can't believe he really thought this and said this. And the OTC in particular was interesting because Jonas and Professor Valdez did talk about how, like, if you're repeating the shooter's comments, then isn't that reinforcing that racist belief? And I do think that's true, but I think it's also important to, like, have his words be out there to expose them and raise awareness about why it was wrong to say something like that, and why it's unfounded, and why we need to do something about it.
Before we keep moving forward, did you want to add anything else about your article?
I think, like, more broadly, it felt very therapeutic to write it. The week that we went home, I shared it on Facebook, and I said, I think this is the most important article I've written for the review, and also the most personal. I've never really been able, was never really needed to talk about Asian racism in that way. And at the time, it was really, well, it still is, but it was really devastating to, like, arrive at a historical moment where we needed to talk about it. But at the same time, I feel like a lot of Asian Americans aren't really afforded the opportunity to speak about prejudice against their race, just because against, like, the global context of racism in the U.S., it's complicated, and, like, it's, like, you can't exactly prioritize stuff like that. Or put it on a hierarchy or a pedestal. I feel like, I went into this article wanting to raise awareness about the event and have the chance to speak up about it, because I had been kind of reading about stuff like this throughout the semester, but didn't really get the chance to write about it. And I think that's where I felt really grateful for the review, for, like, the opportunity to actually write about something like this. And I was really happy with how the article came out. And it was pretty well received, which I liked.
Yeah, I thought it was an excellent article. And, you mentioned this a couple times now, how it was important for you to share this because, especially, even with the gains made in raising awareness now of the violence and anti-Asian sentiment going on, that in the context of this article, that really hadn't happened at all yet. And so you were trying to get this out there. Over a year later, we have the hashtag Stop Asian Hate movement growing. Can you share your perspective on that?
Yeah, it's complicated because I think because I wrote this article like a whole year prior, I think my reaction to the hashtag was not negative, but I think, like, I couldn't help but feel a little bit cynical, actually, and I think it was in conjunction with the fact that I was taking Asian American history and I was learning about all these awful hate crimes, like, historically all semester. So when I heard about the shooting initially, I thought, like, oh my god, that's terrible. But also, I'm not even that really surprised because I had been keeping track of, or, like, staying in tune with these kinds of acts for over a year. And I think at that point I was becoming a bit desensitized because I think a lot of people might not know this, but last spring, there was a incident in Texas, I believe, where an Asian American family was stabbed outside of a Sam's Club, and they were not Chinese. And the victims included a 2-year-old child and a father. And no one really talked about it. And that was really surprising because this was, like, an explicitly violent, like, very physically violent act, and people didn't really connect it to anti-Asian sentiment. And I think it was because, like, they claimed that the perpetrator's motive was unclear or something like that. So when the shooting happened, I thought, like, okay, this is serious and this is, like, explicitly violent. There's no way people can ignore this at this point. But at the same time, I felt kind of cynical about it because not only has this been going on for the last year, but violent racism against Asians has been going on for centuries. And historically, that has been covered up because we, like, historically tend to relegate Asian Americans to the sidelines. And a lot of what I learned in history classes as a kid was more about, like, it was a very binary black versus white struggle. And like occasionally Native Americans would be included, but I didn't hear anything about Asian Americans. And I sort of joke about this to some friends, but it kind of feels like in traditional American public schools, it's like Asians did not show up until World War II when Japanese people were interned, and then they just disappeared again. Because that's really all you hear about them. And even if at that, because I didn't learn about them when in like elementary school and stuff like that. So the hashtag, you know, it was fine. I appreciated the effort, and I think it's a good thing overall. But I was talking about this with a friend, and I feel like it's hard to stay invested because it kind of feels like a repeat of the rise in Black Lives Matter hashtags over the summer, and how even that by now has kind of faded out a little bit. So it's kind of like, okay, we get our kind of like 5 minutes right now, but people are already kind of moving on from the Atlanta shooting. And I guess it's hard to like wonder like how much real change this is going to invoke. And I know this makes it sound super cynical and like depressing, but I think the important thing is like we need to keep, if anything, like this has shown us that we need to keep this conversation ongoing, and we need to listen to people who actually want to speak up about it. Because I remember hearing from Black classmates last year how like they actually found it really exhausting that people were reaching out to them. And for me particularly, it felt really strange to have suddenly have friends being like, I just want to check in on you and see how you're doing. Because of course I understand their sentiment. I know they have good intentions. But like, it feels weird to kind of be thrust into that spotlight for a minute. Especially how after like I wrote my article like over a year ago, and I was like, I think that's really all I wanted to say about it. So now it's just like, I don't know, what else can I contribute to the conversation? But I think this is the time where we can defer to activists and historians and academics and people who actually know this history and are willing to share more about it. Because these are people who actually want to educate people and raise awareness. And I think it's important to defer to them rather than just kind of turning to your Asian classmate being like, tell me how I can help. Because honestly, I don't even know if I have all the answers or if they will. And sometimes it can be overwhelming. And I think that's kind of what I learned from hearing from like Black classmates last year after George Floyd. So overall, I appreciate that it's happening. I appreciate that like people are raising awareness about it, and definitely people who are raising awareness and the people who are willing to learn. But I felt a little bit cynical because it's like, well, I wrote this article over a year ago and now we're finally getting a hashtag. So I think that's kind of my overall feelings about it.
Yeah, I think that's very valid. And I think that point about putting effort into keeping the conversation going is key because, I forget where I what article I read, but the occurrence of tragedy can really fuel public outcry. But it's not, as we've seen, it's not sustainable. And that can be really, really disappointing and disheartening, especially when we're trying for more awareness and also some sort of action by local and federal officials. Like I was surprised that the focus on the Black Lives Matter movement lasted as long as it did, because we've seen before how easily that focus can shift away. Yeah, I hope we can find a way to keep this conversation going as well. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Jamie, before we end our conversation?
Yeah, I do want to acknowledge my own privilege here because I feel like because I'm learning remotely in New Jersey right now, I feel very physically safe. I don't really go out in public too often. And, you know, when I went to go get my vaccine, I felt completely safe because I was in a town where there was a significant Asian American population. I saw a lot of Asian people in line. Nobody gave me a hard time or anything. And I think, like, more broadly, I was really honed in on anti-Asian violence last spring. And I remember thinking at the time, like, I don't want to be in this spot. Like, this is really uncomfortable. And I don't want, like, people of my race to be so heavily scrutinized and be discriminated against. And that's not fair. But then it made me kind of reflect and think, like, okay, well, we do occupy kind of a, not all of us, but some of us do occupy, like, a more racially higher place in society, and how that really opened me up to, like, how do people of other races might feel every day. And then George Floyd did happen, and all of the national attention was on Black Lives Matter. And that really opened my eyes, because I realized, like, fundamentally, we still live in a very anti-Black society. And that kind of constant surveillance and racism is exhausting for them. And I can't imagine, like, living in kind of a hashtag stop Asian hate moment, but, like, every day. I will say, like, I don't want people to think that, like, stop Asian hate is, like, Asians kind of clamoring for their place in the spotlight, because I think the reality of the situation is I don't think any of us really want to be in this position. None of us really wanted to be in a historical place where some of us were murdered in a drive-by shooting. And it's ultimately a tragedy. And I think, like, the best way to like be productive out of this moment is to start this conversation, keep it going, and raise awareness, and hopefully prevent something like this from happening again.
Right. I think that's a good note to end on. Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you so much. Thank you for giving me the space to talk about this.
Well, thank you for putting the time and effort to talk about it. You're listening to WOBC Oberlin, 91.5 FM, Oberlin College, and Community Radio. This has been The Weekly. All previously aired episodes of The Weekly are publicly available online. You can listen to them at anchor.fm/TheWeekly.